Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Hello, this is another ChrisMartinson.com podcast, and I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson. Today is February 10th, 2012, and the world is in a bit of economic turmoil. Greece is flat-out busted, the EU's in recession, Japan's struggling with a too-strong yen, and the U.S. government is spending at least 40% more than it's taking in revenue for the fourth year in a row. To help us make sense of all this is Jim Rickards, seasoned financier, risk manager, and author of the recent bestseller, Currency Wars. In his book, he describes how currency wars are one of the most destructive and feared outcomes in international economics, and that history shows they always end badly. He warns that today we're engaged in a new currency war, posing risks that every prudent individual should be aware of. For those of you with smoldering concerns about the viability of the world's fiat currencies, I sense this interview is going to toss some gasoline onto that fire. Jim, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you as a guest today.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for inviting me.
Your newest book, Currency Wars, The Making of the Next Global Economic Crisis, doing extremely well, is sitting this morning at number 280 on the Amazon book list. I checked. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yes, we've been very happy with the result. It's been a New York Times and national bestseller and very highly ranked in Amazon. And they have some subcategories in the international economics category. We've been number one for three straight months. So very happy with the reception.
Well, fantastic. And the headline summary of your book, if I could, is that the Fed and other central banks are making a very dangerous gamble that might end well, but if history's any guide, as we said, has a better chance of ending quite badly. Before we get to that endgame, though, can we set the stage? What does history tell us about currency debasement and these sorts of trade wars?
Sure. Well, the currency war in the simplest form, Chris, is it's basically when there's, there's too much debt and not enough growth. The overhang of debt impedes growth because it clogs up bank balance sheets and clogs up the savings to investment mechanism and has a lot of negative effects. There's not enough growth to go around. So countries, in effect, try to steal growth from their trading partners by cheapening their currencies. One way to think about it, imagine you live in a small town. There are four stores. They all sell sort of the same thing, and one of them has a half-off sale. Well, naturally, everyone's going to go to the place that has the half-off sale. Well, it's no different in currencies. You look around the world, there's certain countries that manufacture aircraft. We have Boeing in the United States. There's Airbus in Europe, Embraer in Brazil, and China's got an up-and-coming aircraft industry. Well, imagine you're Thailand or Indonesia, a country that needs aircraft but doesn't manufacture them. You're going to buy them from one of those countries, and if you cheapen the dollar, it makes the Boeing aircraft a little cheaper and helps some sales. From that, you get exports, which contributes to growth, and you probably get some additional jobs on the Boeing assembly line. So it sounds good. It's very tempting. It sounds like a free lunch. Why not do it? And indeed, the Fed and the Treasury are trying to do that right now. They're trying to cheapen the dollar, partly for the reason I mentioned. The problem is it doesn't stop at that. It invites retaliation. And this is why I give so many historical examples as well as analysis. A couple things happen. Number one, we cheapen our currency, but other countries try to cheapen their currency also. So you get into these tit-for-tat devaluations where nobody wins. All you do is unleash inflation, restrict world trade without anyone getting an advantage. I like to say that in the currency wars, all advantage is temporary. You give it up pretty quickly. The other thing is for countries that can't necessarily devalue, they can use capital controls. They can use import excise taxes. Currency wars can turn into trade wars. Ultimately, they can even turn into shooting wars. So you get all these bad effects. So if the U.S. could cheapen the dollar in isolation and nothing else happened, maybe there'd be some quick advantage, but that's not what happens. And so, but it's a temptation that politicians and policymakers can't resist, but it ends very badly. Just to give two specific examples I talk about in the book, I give the history of what I call Currency War One, from 1921 to 1936, and Currency War II from 1967 to 1987. In Currency War I, we went through that coterminous to a great extent with the Great Depression. World trade collapsed. Currencies collapsed. Unemployment skyrocketed. Just a set of disastrous outcomes. In Currency War II, we had the opposite. We had borderline hyperinflation. You know, when President Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard in 1971, at the time, his aides predicted this would create 500,000 new jobs over the next 2 years. Instead, the United States entered on one of the worst periods of economic performance in its history outside the Great Depression. We had three recessions back to back to back in 1974, 1979, 1981. So what these historical examples show is that you either get depression or inflation, but either way, it's a bad outcome. But you would think the policymakers and politicians would understand and learn the lessons of history, but they don't, and they're just attempted to launch these currency wars over and over again, but they always end badly.
You know, I want to, right at the beginning, you said that debt is the original reason that we start these currency wars. So maybe in the first period you mentioned, in the 20s, early 30s, that was arguably debt left over from World War One, and so ever since the 1970s, debt levels worldwide, but in the U.S. specifically, have consistently, year after year, risen faster than GDP. You know, just a few percentage points each year, but debt trumped income. In enabling all of that, I feel, was the steadily falling interest rates from the peaks in 1980 all the way on down through to current. And now Bernanke signaled rates are going to stay pegged at zero on the short end until 2014 and be lower than otherwise on the long end because of Operation Twist and whatever else might come next. How long can they keep playing this game, do you think?
Well, they can play it until they can't. And I mean, not to be glib, but the problem I see, and Chris, you're absolutely right about the debt, going back to Currency War One. The debt in that case consisted of German war reparations, reparations that came out of the Treaty of Versailles that ended World War One, and Germany owed unpayable debts to England and France. But England and France also owed unpayable debts to the United States because they had borrowed money to fight World War One. So you had the spectacle of the entire world in debt. None of it could be repaid. Ultimately, none of it was repaid. I mean, eventually Adolf Hitler repudiated the reparations and the United States forgave the war debt, and we ended up in World War II and the whole thing was forgotten. Then in 1944, we rebooted the international monetary system at the Bretton Woods Conference. But that was one contributor to the Great Depression. There were others, but that helped to start the currency wars. In the 1970s, you had a different set of debt. You had what was known as the guns and butter policy, really started by President Lyndon Johnson in 1965, but the effects of it were first seen in terms of currency wars in 1967. The guns part was the massive expansion of the U.S. presence in Vietnam. We'd been in Vietnam for a long time, but Johnson started to send tens of thousands and ultimately hundreds of thousands of troops there, and that was very costly. But at the same time, he launched the Great Society program of entitlements and benefits, which added to the domestic spending. The combination caught up with the United States very quickly to the point that we were, as I say, the dollar was suffering and inflation was breaking out in the 1970s. So debt was the problem in both cases. No different today. I see the same thing today. When you look at the European sovereign debt crisis, Japan's debt-to-GDP ratio over 200%, far worse than Greece, by the way. The United States, it's officially 100%, but that only counts the bonded debt. When you throw in, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, Federal Home Loan Bank System, student loans, and all the other liabilities that the government has underwritten, the actual ratio is 1,000%, meaning 10 times GDP. None of this debt can be repaid, by the way. So what will happen is governments are going to try to inflate their way out of it. It's as if we'll say to the Chinese, hey, we owe you $1 trillion. Here's your $1 trillion. Good luck buying a loaf of bread because we've completely debased the currency. So there's no question, it's quite clear, that the Treasury and the Fed are trying to inflate their way out of the problem and debase the dollar. The problem I see is they might not get there, and here's why. The Fed thinks they're playing with a thermostat. You know, you can, if the room's too cold, you dial it up. If the room's too hot, you dial it down by adjusting the money supply and working a little bit with expectations on the behavioral side. They can gradually tweak economic behavior and lending and spending velocity and money supply to achieve a desired result. The problem is they're actually playing with a nuclear reactor. They're playing with a complex system that's in or near the critical state. Now, you can dial a nuclear reactor up and down, but if you get it right, the consequences are worse than, you know, having to put on a sweater. The consequences are catastrophic. You can melt down the reactor and ultimately the entire financial world. So the danger I see is the Fed thinks they're playing with a thermostat, but they're playing with a nuclear reactor, and they risk collapsing the entire system.
So this idea of complexity and stability, very important, I believe. Our economic and financial systems, they are complex systems, which means they're inherently stable until they're not. At which point they often, and historically we can find, they rather rapidly find a new equilibrium point once we're past some sort of disturbed threshold. How do you see the world financial system going forward? Is it a binary event? Either it survives or it crashes, or is there some happy, slower medium in there?
Well, I don't think there's necessarily a happy medium. I agree completely, Chris, with the way these things play out. You either have a catastrophic collapse or you do one or more smart things to step back from the brink. You know, sometimes in making my recommendations, people say, you know, hey, Jim, you want to go backwards? And my answer is, if you're about to drive off a cliff, going backwards is a very good idea. The other thing, you're right about how complex systems collapse. So the thing that's less well understood is that the risk or the degree of collapse in a complex system is not just a linear function of scale. It's an exponential function. And what that means in plain English is that if you triple or quadruple, let's say, the amount of derivatives on bank balance sheets, you know, Wall Street would tell you you're not increasing the risk at all because you have longs and shorts offsetting. It's very clear that that's incorrect. That's not a proper understanding of the statistical properties of risk. In fact, the risk is not in the net. It's in the gross. So if you increase the gross volume of derivatives, let's say, by five times, you've increased the risk. But a lot of people would say, well, maybe then you've increased the risk by a factor of five. But the answer is no. If you increase the size by five times, you've probably increased the risk by 100 times or 1,000 times. In other words, it's an exponential function. This is the way complex systems work. But again, it's not understood on Wall Street. And this is why policymakers are surprised over and over. You know, they didn't see the crash in 2007, 2008 coming. When it started, they underestimated the severity of it. When they responded, they underestimated the duration of it. They got everything wrong. Well, again, if you're looking through the wrong end of the telescope, you are going to get everything wrong. This just comes as no surprise because they're using the wrong paradigms and the wrong methods of understanding how the world actually works. You know, I hear these Wall Street guys and they say they have these, you know, catastrophic so-called black swan type events, and they say, well, you know, I need to go back and fix my models. And my answer is, no, your models are fine. Your paradigm is wrong. In other words, you have correctly modeled a false reality, and until you understand how things actually work, you're never going to get it right. So therefore, it is that kind of collapse is a likely outcome. You can step back from it, and the key is to descale the system, break the system into pieces so that if individual pieces fail, it doesn't cause contagion, take down the system as a whole. My favorite example is J.P. Morgan. I mean, J.P. Morgan Bank today is the result of five different banks, each one quite large in and of itself. When I started in banking, you had Manufacturers Hanover, you had Chemical Bank, you had the Chase Bank, you had an old version of J.P. Morgan, and other banks all merged into one. Why not break them up into pieces? You know, why not ban over-the-counter derivatives? I think exchange-traded futures are fine, because they have a lot of controls around them, but the over-the-counter derivatives do not. You know, get rid of the dangerous products, break up the big banks, and then move forward. You still have an economy and a financial system, but you have a lot less risk.
So let me ask you something very specifically around this, which has been puzzling me for a while, and I've dug, and I can't find an answer that satisfies me. So the ISDA and European regulators bent over backwards in order to avoid triggering a default event, a credit event, on the Greek CDS. Paper that's outstanding. And so I looked at that, and there's 78 billion notional on it, of which, you know, the net exposure was said to be in the vicinity of maybe 3.8 billion, of which at auction, if they settled that out at 50 cents on the dollar, there's maybe 1.7 billion of total exposure. Why are they bending over so hard to avoid such a nominal amount of money?
Well, I wouldn't say they're bending over hard. I would say they're utterly corrupt, meaning, clearly, it is a default. Their failure to call it that just shows how corrupt the system actually is. But getting to your specific question, Chris, the reason is that if you actually did declare a default, the exposure is not the net of, you know, kind of 1 or 2 billion that you described. The exposure is the whole 78 billion, because I just take, you know, a single institution. Let's say I'm 5 billion long, and I'm 4.9 billion short. And I'm going to lose the entire value of my 4.9 billion short. Well, the only way I preserve myself is if I can go to the 5 billion long and collect. But what if I can't collect? What if it's AIG? In other words, this is not just about market risk and notional risk. It's also about credit risk. So the only way the net is meaningful is if I'm certain that I can collect on my long in case my short has lost value. But they're not certain about that. When you start having institution go to institution to collect the entire gross value of the bet, you're going to have failures. You're going to have people who can't pay, and then that will cause a set of dominoes to collapse the entire system. So the reason they're trying so hard to posture the way you described, which is, you know, netting out the longs and shorts, going to the net amount, you know, marking it to market, you know, some value, et cetera, is because the reality of the gross exposure is one that would take down the entire system. But that is the reality, and to pretend otherwise just shows how desperate they are.
So let's talk about that desperation a bit, because if we take this dynamic of the past four decades, which simply enough was just one of debt growth exceeding income growth, this seems to be what Bernanke, ECB, Bank of Japan, everybody's trying to preserve the system. But I think anybody with a sixth grade math skill and a calculator can tell you that that game ends sooner or later. Does the Fed lack sixth grade math skills, or what's their end game here? I don't even understand how this game plays out. Sooner or later, you have to get your debt back in line with your income. Period.
Right. Well, when you have this much debt overhang, and I think you've described the problem correctly, Chris, there are only three ways out. The first way out is default, and we're seeing that increase today. The second way out is inflation, and this is the preferred method of the Fed and the Treasury. Now, you'll never hear a Fed chairman say, we're working really hard to get some inflation into the system, although, interestingly, Bernanke has said some things very recently that were very revealing along those lines. He said, we don't want too much, but he's very candid about targeting 2% inflation and has gone on to say, we might overshoot the target a little bit or things might get a little bit out of control. We could have something higher. To me, that's revealing because there's no doubt that what they're really shooting for is 4% inflation. They want the shock factor. In other words, they want to guide your expectations to 2, then actually produce 4 so that people will sit up and take notice and say, gee, I better do one or two things. I better go out and buy that car, buy that refrigerator before prices get out of control, or buy that new house just to prop up asset values. The other thing is that at that point you'll have steeply negative real interest rates, meaning if the nominal rate on the loan is 1%, but inflation is 4%, then the real cost of borrowing is negative 3. The lender's paying you to borrow. You can pay them back in cheaper dollars. I like to say it's like renting a car and driving around and returning it with the gas tank half empty but not having to pay for the gas. So that's what the Fed's trying to do. They're trying to get that lending and spending machine going again, get the velocity of money up, and kind of inflate their way out of this problem. A couple problems with that. Number one, 2% inflation is not so benign. 2% inflation cuts the value of the dollar in half. Cuts the value of the dollar by 75% in the course of a typical lifetime. So it cuts it in half in 35 years, and then in the following 35 years cuts it in half again. So now you're down 75% from where you started. So from the time you're born to the time you die, your dollar's going to lose 75% of its value. That's in 2% inflation. In 4% inflation, it'll cut the value of the dollar in half by the time your children go to college. So these are cancerous rates of inflation. They're not, the 2% sounds warm and fuzzy. It's not. The other thing economists say is, who worries about inflation because your wages are going up and it all comes out in the wash. Well, I mean, it's this kind of thing that only an economist could say. The fact is, some of it does come out in the wash on average, but we don't live on average. We live our individual experiences. And the fact is, in inflation, there are winners and there are losers. The winners are people who can see it coming, who understand what you and I and hopefully the listeners are talking about, and hedge their position by getting gold or silver or land or fine art or investing in railroads, as Warren Buffett did, or doing some kind of hard asset play. The losers, those are savers, people with insurance policies, annuities, pensions, retirement plans, anything denominated in dollars that are not going to go up when the inflation kicks in. So inflation is really a form of theft, taking from everyday Americans and giving to elites, hedge funds, bankers, and other people who understand, again, what we're talking about. So these are not benign numbers, but they do reveal the Fed's hand. The Fed is out to inflate away the debt. The third way out, in addition to default and inflation, is growth. I mean, what happened to growth? And the neo-Keynesian economists like to talk about the trade-off between consumption, which is just individual spending, and government spending. They have this concept of aggregate demand, where they say, aggregate demand is falling short of target, like we're not spending enough money, and consumers won't step up. So government has to step up and fill the gap between what consumers are doing and the theoretical aggregate demand. Well, whatever happened to investment? I mean, investment is part of GDP. The economists act as if consumption and government spending were the only two things that mattered. And of course, net exports is another part of it, but that's where the currency wars come in. But what about investment? Investment is doubly beneficial. When you spend it, you get GDP immediately, and then if it's productive, you get improved productivity and GDP down the road. So it's kind of a twofer. So we had to move from a consumption-driven economy to an investment-driven economy, but instead the neo-Keynesians just want to substitute government spending for individual spending, and that's just part of this road to ruin.
Well, I think part of their flaw, as I see, is they were expecting that a couple of $1 trillion poured into the gas tank would have got us revved up and moving, and it hasn't. And one explanation for that is when I check out an oil chart, I can find exactly zero historical examples of a recovery happening at the inflation-adjusted equivalent of $100 per barrel oil.
Right.
Do you have any thoughts on peak oil or energy prices and how those factor into this pile of debt?
Well, certainly high energy prices are going to impede the recovery, and we're getting that not just from kind of the prospect of inflation, which we've talked about, but also because of geopolitical concerns in the Middle East. And I think those concerns are going to become more acute as the year goes on, and the price of oil will go higher. So I'm not really an expert on peak oil, but I am an expert on geopolitics, and I can see that driving the price of oil significantly higher. And again, the data is unquestionably what you described, which is that's not the foundation or the basis for recovery. So in addition to all the other headwinds I talked about, which is, you know, low money velocity, you know, negative home equity, excess debt at the consumer level, deleveraging, in addition to all that, we have this high price of oil, which is just another headwind. So again, it's all the more reason to think that the Fed's got their work cut out for them. But what concerns me is that instead of just sort of acquiescing to deflation and letting prices find their level, letting the housing market find its level to the point where people actually want to buy housing or buy stocks on fundamental reasons, instead they insist on propping up the asset bubbles through asset price inflation and ultimately consumer price inflation. That will end badly, but it's very hard to say when.
So let me back up then to where you said that, you know, Bernanke said 2% is what we're targeting, wink, wink, but he wouldn't be unhappy with 4%. So they've already got interest rates at zero. They've already got as much liquidity in the system as I've ever seen. They've expanded their balance sheet by a factor of 3. They've done all these things, and we don't have a whole lot of inflation going on by official measures. Do we interpret that as another round of QE is on the way? And if so, when would you think that might happen, given politics or election cycles or anything else?
Sure. I think there are two interpretations, Chris, that are consistent with each other. I like to say it's a sad thing, a sad sight, when the Fed is trying to get inflation and can't get it. So you're right. We haven't, despite printing over $2 trillion in the last 3 years, we haven't seen much inflation in the United States. But there are two reasons for that. Number one, there's a very, very powerful deflationary vector coming out of the fact that we're in a depression. I don't really think in terms of double dips and recession cycles. I think we're in a depression. I think it began in 2007. It's probably going to continue till 2014, perhaps longer, depending on policy. So there's a natural rate of deflation coming from that as balance sheets deleverage, assets are shed, prices get marked down, you know, et cetera. But then there's inflation, which is induced by the Fed through policy. So what you have is sort of like two giant tectonic plates pushing against each other. It's the North Pacific plate pushing against the North American plate. Just because there's not an earthquake right now doesn't mean the tensions are not building up below the surface. I think the same thing is true when I see a CPI report coming in around 2%. What it tells me is that, you know, deflation is probably, you know, 5 or 6, and inflation is probably 7 or 8, and it may net out to 2, but the underlying forces are very powerful, and that could break one way or the other. So that's one reason. But the other reason is that until recently, until about a year ago, China was maintaining a peg to the dollar. What that meant is that as the Fed was printing more and more money, a lot of those dollars were finding their way to China in the form of direct foreign investment, portfolio investment, and China's net export account. And the People's Bank of China said to Chinese companies and others that you can't keep the dollars, you have to give them to us, and we'll give you our currency, the yuan, the Chinese yuan, in exchange, and then use that to pay your bills and your payrolls and all that. Well, what that meant was that the faster the Fed printed dollars, the faster the Chinese central bank had to print yuan to soak up the dollars. So the inflation actually broke out in China. Inflation took off with a vengeance in 2010, 2011, which is highly destabilizing and worrying to the Chinese leadership because traditionally it's a cause of political instability in China. So finally they threw in the towel and did allow their currency to appreciate, go up against the dollar. But that just means the inflation is now going to come back to the United States. Those chickens are going to come home to roost in the form of higher import prices. And this is the flip side of a currency war. You know, currency wars start because people want to cheapen the price of exports, but they forget that the United States imports more than it exports. And when you cheapen the currency, the price of all the things we buy from abroad, whether it's iPads, iPods, clothing, textiles,
petroleum,
European vacations, et cetera, all go up. So I think you can expect to see that inflation creeping in as a byproduct of the currency wars. But yes, we are going to see QE3. They're not going to call it QE3. They're going to call it nominal GDP targeting, which is a fancy way of saying we want nominal GDP to go up, and we don't care how much is inflation and how much is real. We just want the thing to go up because the debt is nominal. And you talked about fifth grade math. This is actually third grade math. 1 + 4 = 5 and 4 + 1 = 5. What the Fed is going to say is they care about the 5. They care about that nominal growth. If it's 1% inflation and 4% real, well, that's a very happy outcome. But they're saying if it happens to be 4% inflation and 1% real, we don't care. We have to get to the 5 one way or another. So that's a signal that the Fed doesn't care about inflation. They're just going to print as much money as they have to. And I think you'll see that probably at the April-May meeting, certainly before the summer. So, yes, that is on the way.
All right. In your book, you describe the end game as paper, gold, or chaos. Give our listeners a brief summary of what you think that end game looks like.
Paper would basically be substituting a new global reserve currency. This is sponsored by the IMF. It's called the SDR, which stands for Special Drawing Rights. And basically, people understand that the Fed has a printing press and they can print dollars. Well, the IMF has a printing press also. They can print SDRs and flood the world with liquidity that way, except there's even less accountability at the IMF level than there is at the Fed level. This will happen the next time we have an acute stage of the financial crisis, something like 2008. The Fed papered it over the last time, but the next time it's going to be too big for the Fed. The Fed increased their balance sheet to $3 trillion. What are they going to do the next time? Increase it to $9 trillion? There are political and practical limits to that, but the world has no limits because we can just print this new world money, global money called the SDRs. And it's nothing new. They've been around since 1969, and some of them were issued, a couple hundred billion were issued in 2009. So that'll be the new world money. Competing with that would be some kind of return to the gold standard where people do lose confidence in paper money. And the SDRs don't do the trick. It's just another form of printing. Countries may have to go to the gold standard, not because they want to, but because they have to restore confidence. The third possibility, chaos, is the one I think that's actually the most likely, not because anybody wants it or anyone plans for it, but because of human nature, denial, wishful thinking, delay, kicking the can down the road, that things just collapse. As we've said before, these catastrophic collapses in complex systems come out of nowhere. They happen very suddenly and when you least expect it. I think that may be what happens here.
Yes, it's certainly, I love the description of the pressures are building, because that's what I see. I see the derivatives are actually higher today than they were in 2008. I see debt levels are actually higher, especially at the official or sovereign level. So these are all just pressures that are building. I can't find any historical examples, maybe you know of one, where a reserve currency has been on the path of trying to weaken itself. I'm not quite clear how that turns out, and I don't know if the world has a better view of how that's going to turn out either. So here we are, and today we've been talking with Jim Rickards, author of Currency Wars, bestseller, The Making of the Next Global Economic Crisis. I highly recommend people read it. Jim, if people want to follow you further after they get your book, how would they do that?
Thanks, Chris. I have a very active Twitter feed. The account is at James G. Rickards, all one word. Rickards is RICKARDS. So you can just follow at James G. Rickards. You don't have to join Twitter yourself. You might want to, but you can just type in that handle and my account will come up, and I put out quite a bit on the international monetary system. So that is one way to follow along, and I invite people to do that.
Excellent. Well, it's been a real pleasure talking with you today, and we'll certainly be tracking your book, how that does, and also what the Fed's going to do before summer.
Great. Thank you, Chris.
All right. My pleasure. Bye.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.